There was fog everywhere, as far as the eye could see, and I thought to myself, this is the sort of morning where most people will want to stay in bed. So it's great to have you here. Thanks for coming. Let's begin by praying. Dear Jesus, we thank you that it's all about you and it's all about your kingdom. We want to humble ourselves this morning. Please speak to us about your kingdom. Teach us a little bit more about your kingdom and teach us a little bit more about what to expect from your kingdom and from your second coming. Amen. Now, when I say the word king, who do you think of? It's the first thing that pops into your mind. For me, I think of Louis the 14th of France. Now, he had a 72-year reign. It's the longest in history that we know about. And it's fair to say that France was extremely successful during his reign as king. There was one problem with him, though. He really loved war. I mean, he really, really loved war. He thought it was the best way to advance his kingdom and to enhance his glory. And he loved it so much that even in times of peace, he was planning for the next war. What about Genghis Khan? Genghis Khan was this amazing Mongolian ruler. Now, he established the largest land empire in history, and he did it by uniting tribes that were previously at war. He did quite a few good things. For example, he abolished torture. Apparently, he was one of the people who first thought of the passport as an idea. So he did some good things. However, he was also responsible for widespread slaughter. Apparently, about 40 million people died because of his conquests. Now, on top of that, he also loved women way too much. He had 6 wives and over 500 concubines. Apparently, geneticists today estimate that there are 16 million men who are alive today who are the direct descendants of Genghis Khan. That's like 1% of the population. I know, it's horrible, isn't it? What about Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon? We read about him in Daniel. He was this awesome warrior king. However, the biblical account tells us that he was also incredibly proud. And he was so proud, in fact, that God afflicted him with a type of mental illness where he actually thought that he was a wild animal. And so he grew his hair long, he stripped all of his clothes off, he grew his nails out really long, and he went off into the wilderness and lived like a wild animal. I think it was for like 7 years or something like that. He was a good king until that happened. What about David, King David? He was a great king. He was sort of the archetypal king of the Old Testament. But of course, when he died, he left his kingdom to his son Solomon. And the kingdom fell apart because his son was not very capable as a king. But what about Jesus? That's what I want us to consider this morning. What type of king is Jesus? And what can we expect from his kingdom when it is fully revealed to us? This is all part of a 3-sermon series that we've been working through. This is the 3rd sermon. The first one, we met the Canaanite woman, didn't we? We met if you were here, you'll remember the Canaanite woman came to Jesus. She was an enemy of God and his kingdom. However, she wanted to be a part of his kingdom, and Jesus, as the king of his kingdom, accepted her even though she was an enemy. In the second sermon, we met Jesus as the king who takes up his cross, who denies himself, and who builds God's kingdom, furthers his kingdom by saying, "Not my will, but yours be done." And he asks us to do the same. And we saw a little of his coming glory when he was transfigured. And as he was transfigured, the veil was lifted just for a few short moments. And we saw behind the curtain, and we saw into the heavenly realm, and we saw Jesus, the King, high and lifted up and exalted. Now, for this third and final sermon, we're going to look at 2 passages that have just been read out, Matthew chapter 21 and Revelation chapter 21. Now, as we go through, I'm not going to go through verse by verse. Rather, I'm just going to pick out a few key themes that we're going to focus on, and we're going to look at how these two passages relate to one another. So with that in mind, let's dive right into the Matthew passage. Now, the first thing I'd like to point out about this scene of Jesus entering into Jerusalem is that he enters the city on a donkey. Now, this was a very strange choice. Most kings would enter their capital city on a war horse or a chariot. Jesus enters on a donkey. Now, donkeys were used by merchants and priests. That's if they were well-bred donkeys. If they were a donkey that was a beast of burden, then it would more likely be a servant who would use it. So this is a sign of meekness and peace. It is not a sign of aggression. As I said, most kings would rather go the other way and show their might and their power. Julius Caesar did this. Apparently, when he came into Rome after his successful conquest of Gaul, Gaul is modern-day France, when he conquered them, he came back into Rome and he was on his chariot and his chest was out and he had his laurel wreath around his head and he had his soldiers parading in front of him. And he also brought with him the captives, the slaves, the people who he had conquered and were now his slaves. He paraded them out for everyone to see. And all of the things, all of the loot that he had gotten from this conquest, he would parade that as well. It was a show of force and strength. He was saying, look at me, look what I've accomplished. I've taken over this kingdom and now I have all these slaves. But not Jesus. When he entered into his capital city, he came riding in on a donkey. It's a sign of peace. King Jesus is a man of peace. And we get this from the Zechariah passage, actually, that prophecy that Matthew quotes in verse 5 is from Zechariah 9. And I'll read it out now in full because it's very relevant to our topic. The title in my Bible is The Coming King of Zion. And it says this, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." Now get this. So that was the part that Matthew quoted. But this is what the prophecy goes on to say. "I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off." Now these three terms, the chariot, the war horse and the battle bow, these are all terms of war, aren't they? They're terms of war and conquest and might and power. And he says, "I'm going to do away with them." Then it says, "He shall speak peace to the nations, and his rule shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." So it's going to be a kingdom of peace, and it's going to encompass the entire earth. The whole earth shall be at peace. Now, it's fair to say this is not what the crowds expected at all. Of course, it was, don't get me wrong, it was still a picture of celebration and honour. We see that in verse 8. Most of the crowd spread their cloaks on the road, they cut branches from trees, they spread them in front of Jesus to sort of welcome him home, almost like a red carpet, if you like, being rolled out. So it is a picture of celebration and honour, and this is what they used to do in the Old Testament for their victory parades when a triumphant king would return home. And we think, good, they're welcoming Jesus as their king. That's got to be a good thing, right? Well, not so fast, because this crowd had an expectation on Jesus that wasn't all that helpful at all. And it's hard for us to see it, but it's right there in verse 9. "Some of the crowds went before him and they followed him and they were shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David." Now, it's that title that I just want to hone in on for a second here. If you were here for the first sermon, you'll remember, possibly, that the Canaanite woman actually used this title when she addressed Jesus. She said, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me, for my daughter is severely afflicted by a demon." She said, "Son of David." And at the time I said, look, this just basically, on one level, this means that she's calling him the King of Israel. And that's true. But there's also a problem with this title. See, it actually started off back in the Old Testament in 2 Samuel. God promises David that he would establish an everlasting kingdom through his offspring. Okay, so far so good. But then the promise develops, and there's various prophecies that God will save Israel and establish an everlasting kingdom. You can read about that in Isaiah, for example, chapter 9 and 11. But the problem is that by Jesus' time, this title, Son of David, had actually taken on new life. It had grown, and it had actually carried certain expectations. The expectation was that God would raise up a warrior king. He would be like a political messiah. He would gain power, he would build up an army, and then he would lead those armies out against the Romans. He would destroy the Romans. He would free his people from their rule. He would allow them to worship Yahweh their God in their temple and in their way without any Roman interference. And possibly, best of all, they wouldn't have to pay taxes to Caesar. Now, they wanted Jesus to be their king, but they wanted a warrior king who would do all of this for them, and Jesus enters on a donkey. Jesus was their Messiah, but he was a different sort of Messiah to what they were expecting and a different sort of Messiah to what they wanted. His kingdom was not what they were expecting at all, and their agenda was not the same. Now, a few weeks ago, I read an article from a parent. And this parent had two kids. And basically the gist of the article was that he was he expressed a lot of remorse that he had had children in the first place. And he went on to say in this article that he expected that having children would somehow add to his life and you know, build him up as a person. And then, of course, when kids came along, there was sleepless nights. The kids screamed all night, of course. He had to change nappies and it just wasn't what he expected at all. And because of that expectation, he began to resent his children, and then he regretted having children at all. It's a really sad story, isn't it? He went on to say at the end of the article, "I recommend that no one have children." Wow. For the record, I do not feel the same way. Now, this is what happened in that article, the expectation, and then the expectations being dashed, and then the disappointment. That's kind of what's happening here. These crowds have that expectation of Jesus. And we know the rest of the story. He enters as the peaceful king. He doesn't meet their expectations. So they say, this cannot be the Messiah. This can't be the one that we're waiting for. He doesn't fit the mold. He doesn't fit all of our expectations. And so they reject him, they kill him, and as he's hanging up on the cross, there's this plaque that they put above his head, mockingly, saying, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." And that's a sad story, isn't it? And it's a reminder that no one can approach Jesus with their own agenda. You see, he is king in his own right, and he has his own agenda for his kingdom. But what is that agenda? That's what we're going to look at now. If the crowds had their expectation of Jesus and their expectation was completely wrong, then what is the expectation that we should have for his coming kingdom and for him as a king? This is where we turn to Revelation chapter 21. This is part of this great vision that John has, the vision that he has behind the scenes. This vision of heaven. And this passage from verse 1 through to 4 of chapter 21 in Revelation, it reveals to us the moment that Jesus' kingdom is actually unveiled. His kingdom is revealed. Now, a number of years ago, I worked in a vineyard up in Lancefield. If you know Lancefield, it's quite a bit inland. And one of my jobs as a vineyard worker was I had to go out and prune the vines. And this always happened in the middle of winter, of course. And so we'd go out like right at the start of the morning when it's cold and foggy, much like today, except 10 degrees cooler usually. There'd be ice hanging from the vines sometimes. and you'd have to massage your hands just to get them working. And the fog was so thick and so heavy that when you were working on a vine, you couldn't see anything around you, just about. You could barely see 10 meters in front of you. And so I would look to the end of my row that I was working on, and I couldn't see the end, and it was quite depressing in a way. And then I'd look behind me, and I wouldn't be able to see much detail in the work that I'd already done. And then I'd look up, and I wouldn't be able to see anything, really. I wouldn't be able to see the hills in the background or the blue sky. It was just this thick, oppressive fog. And then a few hours later, you're working along, and you'll look up, and you'll realize that the fog has lifted. And instead of fog, you can see blue sky, and you can see the hills over there, these green rolling hills. It's just this beautiful panorama, this beautiful view. And the birds would start singing, you'd see the flowers over there. It's just beautiful. And then I'd look to the end of my row, and I'd actually see the end. And I'd think, oh good, there's an end in sight. And I'd look behind me, and I could see a little bit better the work that I had already done. Now, in a way, that is what it will be like when Jesus' kingdom is revealed. Just like the fog lifting, it'll be like its glory, the glory and beauty of his kingdom will all of a sudden be right there. It will no longer be obscured. We'll be able to see it and touch it. And we can be assured that one day Jesus will reveal his kingdom. There will be an unveiling, like the fog lifting. And there are three things, or three agendas, that Jesus has that I would like to point out from this passage and the Matthew passage that we just looked at. Now, the first thing I'd like to point out is that when Jesus comes, his kingdom will cover the whole earth, not just Jerusalem. Therefore, the whole world will be at peace. We see here in verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Jesus' rule will cover the entire earth. Therefore, it will be at peace. We saw that in the Zechariah quote from Matthew just before, that Jesus intends to unite the world. No more wars, no more kingdom against kingdom. The whole world will be his Jerusalem. The crowd expected Jesus to be their king, just the king of Israel ruling in Jerusalem. But Jesus' agenda was so much bigger than that. He wanted to encapsulate all kingdoms, all people, and the whole earth would be his. Now, the second thing I'd like to point out is that every tear will be wiped from his people's eyes. We see that in verse 4. Every tear will be wiped from their eyes. Death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things will have passed away. I'd just like us to look at verse 1 as well, because there's this really big hint that he gives us there. I saw the new heavens and the new earth, for the first heavens and the first earth had passed away. Then he says something strange. He says, and the sea was no more. It's an odd thing for him to say. What does he mean? Does he mean that there won't be any more oceans in the new heavens and the new earth? Well, not exactly. Revelation is a book that uses a lot of symbolism. And this word here, the sea, is used to mean something else. You see, in the Bible, the sea is actually used to mean chaos. It's used all the way through, from Genesis all the way through to Revelation. It means chaos. It means things that have the power to destroy and harm. We see right at the beginning in Genesis, God creates the world, and there was this heaving sea, there was this churning chaos, and God created order out of the chaos. Then we see the Israelites stuck between the sea and Pharaoh's armies, and God had to separate the sea in order for them to pass through. And then again it happened as they were passing into the promised land. Again they had to pass through waters. And going back a little bit, I've skipped over this, but also there was a flood, wasn't there, where God actually destroyed everything and he used this giant flood to turn the whole world into a sea, and that destroyed everything. And then by the time the disciples came along, they thought of the sea in much the same way, as it's this place of chaos. And then when they're out on the boat, Jesus calms the sea and he walks on water. You see, all the way through, the sea means potential destruction, chaos, pain. But in Jesus' kingdom, in this new heavens and new earth that we read about in Revelation, there will be no more sea. There will be nothing at all that has the power to harm, nothing at all that could even potentially hurt you. Can you even imagine this? It's hard, isn't it? I tried to think of a way to describe this. You might have noticed I use a lot of stories to convey messages, but I couldn't think of anything to say here. It's just so hard to imagine. Because everything that we experience now in this creation is in some way marred by the effects of sin and the fall. Because ever since the fall, we haven't experienced creation the way that we were intended to. There is usually some sort of pain or grief that comes between us and the full experience of joy. And we all have examples of this. Our joy is tinged with sadness. It's mixed with pain so often. However, it won't always be this way. In the new creation, in his kingdom, we will experience paradise. We will experience a world where it'll be like the Garden of Eden before sin actually came into the world, before sin entered and corrupted things. Before sin entered the world, God's intention was for people to enjoy his creation to the fullest. And the good news is that's still his intention. That is still his agenda. We will enjoy God's creation without any pain or grief coming between us and our joy. Now, thirdly, and most importantly, when Jesus' kingdom is revealed, his people will dwell forever with him. And this is really the ultimate goal of the Christian, isn't it? To dwell forever with Christ in his presence. We see that in verse 3. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God." We will see him face to face and live with him. We will enjoy the new creation alongside him. Psalm 16 verse 11 says that in God's presence there is fullness of joy and pleasures forevermore. And that is God's agenda. Right now we do dwell with God in a sense, don't we? However, the veil is still down. It's as though the fog hasn't lifted yet. We're still working along in this world, knowing that God's there, but not having the full experience yet. We don't experience him or his kingdom in the fullest sense. But Jesus' agenda is that one day he will return and we will live with him. And when he does, we will experience him and his new creation like never before. Then our joy will be complete and our joy will be full. Now, in a few moments, we're going to take communion. And when we take the bread and the wine, normally what we do is we look back on what was done for us with gratitude and thankfulness. We look at the sacrifice that was given for us so that we could be included in Jesus' kingdom. And that's a good thing. I still want us to do that. But today, let's also look forward as we take the emblems. Let's look forward to the coming of Jesus, his second coming, and let's look forward to the moment that his kingdom will be unveiled in all of its glory and in all of its joy. I think we're just going to have one more song, is that right? And then we're going to take communion.